Welcome to the Film Experience. I'm pleased to welcome back Nick Davis.
Hello.
And Murtada.
Hello. How's everybody doing?
I'm hanging in there. Cheers. No.
We have to have a sequel to last week's podcast. Because we have to know what Nick thinks about the Oscar changes.
Am I the Lily James of this podcast? I'm like the added character for people.
Cousin Oliver.
who am I playing? Do I have a boat? I don't think anything about the new Oscar categories that you guys don't already think, and I'm trying to pretend like it's just not happening.
Okay. Well, that might be the best tactic, given that we know nothing about it, literally.
Yeah. And they're at least doing, like, the public performance of, like, soliciting feedback and caring what people think, right? And not that I would know anybody who would be for this, but I haven't read anything by anybody who's for this. So, you know, fingers crossed.
Oh, well, you're lucky then, because there are hot takes that are for it.
And also, a couple of people from the Academy have come out for it in the last couple of days. Anyway, I thought it was going to go away, but now people are actually coming out for it. So maybe it's staying.
Well, Mark Wahlberg is excited about it.
Well, Mark Wahlberg is not riding the highest wave he could possibly ride this weekend. So maybe Mark Wahlberg could suck it.
Rhonda Rousey, I also saw her on TV talking about it. Finally, I can win an Oscar.
Oh, she's overdue. The time has come. This is the year to finally get Cicely Tyson her honorary and Rhonda Rousey her long-deferred... first nomination.
Am I correct, Nick, you have not seen The Wife yet?
I have not. I just read the book, but I haven't seen the movie yet. It opens here in a week.
Oh, okay. Well, before we get to Crazy Rich Asians, I have to ask about the book to The Wife.
Well, one thing that, I mean, I only with the trailer to go on, I can say that one thing that's really key to the book is that the prize that her husband is winning is it's a made-up prize, but it's called the Helsinki Prize in Finland. And the whole point of the prize is that it's kind of for authors who are never going to become prominent enough to win the Nobel. And it's also about Finland trying to have something that drafts off the glory of what, like, of what Norway has. And so the whole point is that they're... she's kind of, like, biting her tongue a lot, that, like, this is a really good prize he's worked really hard for, but let's be real, this is not the Nobel. And, like, a whole lot of the book is about being in Finland and watching people try to pretend to be something that they're not quite. Mm.
Well, that's an added layer that's not in the movie.
Totally, because the movie is the Nobel, right?
Right.
Yeah. And maybe it's just enough to say that, like, the person winning that prize might not invite the entire global scrutiny that you would think would fall on the person who wins the Nobel. So that seems like it matters for some of the plot turns.
Okay.
In terms of how digging people might do.
Well, we will have a sequel once you see it, because I'm very curious.
I'm excited. But you should definitely have Kyle Stevens be part of that podcast, because he loves Glenn Close, and he's rooting for her as ever.
It's true.
We need more fighting in the war room, to borrow the name of another podcast.
Because yeah, I'm definitely firmly in Glenn's corner with this movie.
Yeah?
So we definitely need opposition.
But that's not normal for you.
Not necessarily, no. Yeah, I mean, I rolled my eyes so hard when she took 5 curtain calls when I saw her in Sunset Boulevard.
Did she at least wait till the end of the show to take them, or were they just, like, every few scenes?
Well, she did control herself until the end of the show. If she wants to take as many curtain calls as she wants for The Wife, I'm all for it.
Cool. Control herself is an interesting phrase for Glenn Close. But I'm kind of with her, too. So if this all, like, unfolds in a Still Alice way, like, great.
Yeah. Okay, Crazy Rich Asians. It's making lots of money. It's making lots of money, and people are rooting for it, so that's a nice combo, always. And I thought it was super fun. I know, Murtada, you did too, but Nick, I don't know what you think.
I liked it. I think I might like it, like, in a more mixed way than what I've gathered from the two of you, but yeah, go see it.
Yeah.
I think I'm less enthusiastic than Nathaniel, but yes, I agree, it's really fun, and it was, like, a good time at the movies.
Okay, then maybe we are in the same place.
Well, oh, it's not that it doesn't have issues, I just think it's really successful at what it does, and it's not, thankfully, not trying to do too much, I don't think. Like, it wants to be a good rom-com, and that's what it is.
Yes, if it just wanted to be a glossy, frothy rom-com, then it definitely achieved those ambitions. But I was hoping for more. I was like, where is the social satire?
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a little bit of... There wasn't social satire, but there was a little bit of commentary. Like, the prologue, which actually does seem a little out of place with the movie, because it's not really about what transpires in the movie, other than to explain
mm-hmm.
that they were wealthy right from the beginning.
Yeah, and that was a very strong scene. Like, if we had had a little bit more of that, I think the movie would have been more enjoyable. But it is, you know, I don't want to be opposed to it, because, you know, we talked about Mission Impossible 2 weeks ago, and I was, like, all for it, and it was fun and whatever. And I think I like Crazy Rich Asians more than that, so let's talk about the fun stuff.
Little positivity in the morning.
The fun stuff, do you mean Awkwafina?
Yes, that's a good start for the fun stuff. She was great.
Well, definitely more lively than in Ocean's 8. Like, I kept waiting for her to...
Being positive, I don't know what you don't understand about that.
I was kept waiting for her to pop in Ocean's 8, and just nothing happened. So this was a very happy turn of events for me.
You know, my favorite scene was right at the beginning, the whole Radio 1 Asia thing, where, like, they're talking, and then they start showing you all the people texting and calling, and which is actually in the New York Times site. You can actually see that scene. It's not a spoiler, because it comes in the first 5 minutes. And that was, like, such a highlight, because it shows you how it was very fun and inventive and, you know, a little bit Jane Austen, which is what Kevin Kwan has been talking about, that this is his Jane Austen book, and he was inspired by that, but maybe that's the scene that best captures that spirit.
You're talking about the social media gossip?
Yeah.
Okay.
I remember reading in Justin Chang's review that I didn't know the director was the guy who did most of the Step Up movies, and that he felt like just the abilities with movement and energy and color, that there wouldn't be an obvious crossover from those movies to this one, but that was where he saw it. And I was thinking about that during that text scene. But even there were a couple scenes as the movie went on where I felt like it was keeping things at a pretty steady clip, and like some ways of like shooting big party scenes that didn't just like stop the plot while we looked at a bunch of spectacle, even though there was plenty of spectacle, but he's still really good at kind of following his characters in those scenes. Yeah, I would definitely like to watch another movie directed by him based on the evidence of this one.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't feel too long, which I had kind of expected because of how this genre has been going lately, but also because of the 5,000 subplots in this one, that we were automatically going to be at, like, 2 hours and 20 or something. And the fact that, like, maybe it arguably still takes on a little bit too much, but I would kind of prefer tighter without doing everything it could to, like, keeping us there until the origin story of everyone has been established.
Yeah. I mean, I was surprised at how much they saw through all the side stuff. But it did feel like it, the editing, it didn't feel like an economic use of editing, because it did feel long, but it moved at a steady clip, as you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
I was also worried about a knocked up situation where about half hour before it ended, I was like, can you be over? I'm amused, but can you be over?
And can we talk about how everybody just looked so gorgeous? Like, that's what you need in a romantic comedy. Everybody looked really good. They dressed really good. They gave us all the pauses and the poses. So you get all of that.
Yeah, and I was thrilled. I tweeted about this yesterday, but I was just so thrilled to see Gemma Chan. Because I loved her in that TV show Humans. And I loved her as Astrid in this. And those kind of roles, like, where you have to be someone that people obsess over, they can lead to a lot of just posing, but I felt she pulled that off while also showing how, like, guarded and internal the person was.
So, this, I may be blockheaded, but I understood there were a few moments when Rachel is suggesting that she already knows who Astrid is and is, like, sort of aware of her, like she gestures to that a couple of times in conversation, but I didn't totally get whether that was just a signal of like Astrid's sort of global fame, and it's in a little bit of an interesting tension with Rachel's, even as an economics professor, total unawareness. I mean, not that economics professors know every rich person who exists in the world, but there was just a little bit of a lack, an unclarity there to me.
Yeah, it was not clear in the movie, but in the book, Astrid is the only member of Nick's family that she met before she went to Singapore.
Uh-huh.
So maybe they were just assumed everybody read the book. I don't know. It wasn't clear in the movie, to your point.
Well, and there was a scene where she more or less says that, and so I'm wondering if that scene just got cut at the last minute or something, because
where she says that they had met before?
She says something about, like, oh, somebody who, you know, oh, good, somebody at least I know. And I didn't know if that meant, like, cultural awareness or if they had, you know, or if he's the person he talked about the most on that plane ride over or what it meant. But it sounds actually like what you're talking about, Murtada. Like, they either think we know or they used to have that in the script.
I did like that she didn't know anything about the family because I think that was a good character detail because, at least for me, I like when people in movies don't necessarily know everything about a specific milieu like pop culture.
Yeah, totally.
And so it adds character because why would, she doesn't seem like a frivolous person who would obsess over, you know, somebody who might have their own reality show. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. But she might know somebody who owns most of Singapore and who's like, responses to being threatened are to buy the hotel that is treating them badly immediately, you know, which is like one of the character points I do think gets set up in that first prologue.
Yeah.
Of like, this is how I react to antagonism.
It's to throw money at it.
And quickly and without getting super emotionally big about it.
Because I was half expecting a scene where she is offered money to leave. So that scene where Awkwafina mentions, like, she keeps escalating the amount of money they would pay her to walk out was really funny.
And I was that audience member who's like, take it, go. Like, no, I'm going to play again. Don't do that.
I actually really loved for a romantic comedy that the climactic scene, spoilers, but sorry, that it was between the future mother-in-law and the future bride, as opposed to, you know, usually it's more like, I liked that the man was kind of just window dressing.
He was eye candy and great looking eye candy. So, yeah. And I also, you know, to that point, I like that in the end, the thaw in the relationship between those two women wasn't as like, as much as you would expect in a rom-com. It was just okay enough for them to sort of live reluctantly with each other, and not more than that.
Equal.
Well, I do have a question for you guys about the ending, so anybody listening, that's what's happening. But I did feel a little regretful that I liked the scene we're talking about as a scene, and I also liked it as an unexpected, like you're saying, place for this particular plot and set of characters to have culminated. With respect to which, I kind of thought this is a really satisfying way for this movie to end, and it's really ingenious they came up with it. And then they proceed to another two scenes that are exactly what I thought they had avoided by having the scene they had just had. So it sort of felt like, to me, if at the end of my best friend's wedding, Dermot was like, you know what, though, actually, let's just do this thing, you know? And, like, why go that far out of your way to, like, say something specific about your characters, and unless you just are really confident that your audience is demanding one particular thing. But did you guys feel any kind of way about that?
I mean, it is called Crazy Rich Asians, so I guess they wanted to give us another party. So I was all for that.
Well, we'd already had 9.
Yeah, that's true. There were a lot of parties, but I will say this about the parties. I did feel that a lot of times I worried about them for the reasons you stated earlier, Nick, that we were going to spend too much time with spectacle. I did feel like they were often, thankfully, very quick. Like, especially the bachelor party. When that started, I was like, oh no. And then they just swerve. Awkwafina said, but you can't swerve. But in that case, the movie did.
It's a lot of those parties, and like, I'm interested what you guys think about those two bachelorette parties also, but I did think they managed to put all the wealth on the screen without pretending to be against it, because the movie was obviously really seduced by a lot of that stuff, but I also didn't watch the party scenes wishing I were there, actually. It did not feel like it was necessarily presenting itself as super aspirational, or like there isn't a sort of trade-off. If this is going to be your milieu, that's going to work out for you in some ways, but maybe, you know, have a ceiling in other ways.
This was my problem with the book. The book is just endless explanation of wealth, you know, like pages and pages of describing the houses and the cars and all the money and the list of designer names. And I guess that was my problem with the book. So in the movie, it's visual, so they just show it without actually anybody talking about it for 50 pages or 100 pages out of a 500-page book. So then to me, I liked it more because I didn't have to actually read and spend minutes and minutes thinking of that. But that's also back to my point about the social satire. While, to your point, Nick, it's not maybe as aspirational, but it's also not making any comment on that. It's just taking it as like, yes, this is it, and people should be in love with all these materialistic things, which is okay. It's a rom-com, so maybe it didn't need to delve deep into that. But if it did, it would have been a better movie.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that was how it felt at all, though. I mean, I don't think that the filmmakers or the scriptwriter have any complicated feelings about wealth. I mean, whereas for me, I think it's kind of obscene, but, you know, we're at late-stage capitalism and the world has gone to hell because of all the greed. So it's like, but that's, you know, not part of a rom-com. So in a way, I could totally understand how somebody would hate this movie, actually, if they had a lot of, like, strong political views about how obscene wealth is. But I just went along for it because to me it was, like, kind of like how Sex and the City is. It's grounded in reality about the way, you know, it has elements of reality in the way that wealth affects relationships, as Sex and the City did. But for the most part, it sort of glosses over it and allows you this. It's like you're going to a day spa, and you don't have to think about the bill afterwards.
You're traveling really far to get to that day spa, but you're going to go to that day spa, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we're not even really disagreeing, but I kind of agree with both of those positions in a way. I mean, in a sense, I felt like I got a little bit of that sense of satire by, I haven't read the novel like you have, Murtada, but I don't have the literacy that if I were reading all those brand names and all the ways in which he would have to describe all of that, I would not be able to figure out who's wearing a brand name that codes them as tacky versus who's wearing something really expensive that's also kind of elegant. And watching it made that stuff a little bit clearer to me, without the movie having to verbally kind of belabor it. And it more or less, I felt like, tended to match like who we're supposed to admire or be behind in the movie, which is part of why I got suckered, I'll admit, by the ex at the bachelorette party, because it didn't seem like the movie needed her and Astrid if she wasn't going to go rogue, so like I got that, but like she seemed like somebody the movie was actually kind of sympathetic to at first. I think so much of what I've been reading with this movie has been about how it handles Asian-ness and the different ways in which it's imagining Asian-ness and like Asian nationals versus Asian American immigrants. And the aspect of rich, I think, was the thing that I was more mixed about in how I watched the movie. And like, I do not really crave a version of this movie where we have to spend tons of time with Rachel before the plot gets going. Like, way to go on that. But it is also kind of interesting that we don't get any sense of what her life looks like. Like, she's a tenured economics professor at NYU, so of course I loved that, like, a tenured professor is, like, the dishwater shitbag that nobody could possibly ever marry. Cool. But I did think it set itself up to kind of be an interesting, like, usually movies are about rich versus poor, if they're about money at all, and this felt like it was about really well-to-do versus insanely crazy rich, which potentially I thought could be an interesting thing to investigate. But I agree with you, Murtada, there are ways you could do that without having to just be editorializing against wealth. Like, that's one option, and I totally agree that's not where this movie is, but it doesn't do the other things it could do either.
Well, yeah, I mean, one of the ways that I felt like it dropped the ball there, not necessarily that I wanted it to play with the ball, but was that scene where Rachel goes to Aquafina's character's name, but
Piglin, I think.
Piglin, yeah. She goes to her house, and you get that brief explanation of new money versus old money.
Yeah.
Which felt like something, if you wanted to do more social satire, that's where you would actually house it.
Yeah.
But instead, that was more slapstick.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Kelly Dong on Movie has a really interesting essay about how the race narratives and the money narratives in the movie are interacting, and how she sees the movie using one to try to game its way around the complexities of the other. So anybody who wants to read more, I would totally recommend that.
On Movie?
On Movie, yeah, Kelly Dong.
Okay.
The interesting sort of, like, struggle that they were trying to do is between sort of traditional old country values and immigrant values, which was sort of the main conflict between Rachel and Michelle Yeoh. So that was interesting, but also they didn't dig deeper into it. But again, you know, if your ambition is to just be this romantic comedy, so maybe you don't. I mean, I don't know, but the good ones usually would spend a little bit more time on that, because those were sort of the protagonist and the antagonist, and that's their main difference.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of ways it glosses over a lot of areas where it could have delved into, I just think. But I'm sort of glad it didn't go all those directions, because it was focused enough for me to be really entertaining. Like, I was, you know, my suspension of disbelief a little bit, like, that they'd been together, what did they say, a year?
Yes.
And they had never traveled together or anything? She seemed surprised that they went first class and were spending money on travel.
Well, as a tenured professor, I can say that didn't surprise me quite as much. But that's how we live.
You don't have weekends away ever.
Not to Singapore, or not to, you know, I mean, like, Derek's family who lives in New Zealand, like, it took us 16 years to go visit them, like, that took a long time to save up for. I can tell you the economists are paid better than the literature faculty, but but yeah, it was just understood we're not getting there right away. But it's not about me.
Yeah, I mean, if we wanted to dig deep into anything, there's a lot of things you can nitpick in. Like, I sort of did not like Ken Jeong at all. I was thought he was too broad and offensive, even. But, you know, as a whole...
Isn't that why people hire him, though?
Yeah.
I mean, the very, very broad comedy.
Yeah. But as a whole, it was fun. Lots of beautiful clothes, beautiful people. It's just like it, you leave it feeling good. Like, you know, you spend a good time at the movies. And I think you can't sort of discount that feeling that it, that you get from it.
Mm-hmm. So, no, I mean, I love that part about it. I want to see it again.
You guys mentioned the bachelor parties. Like, to me, that's connected to some of the stuff we're talking about, because the dead fish in the bed scene was kind of shocking to me. And, like, in a movie that is so, like, on the level of, like, frothy fun, we're doing this, but don't worry, we're not, like, really going to do this. Like, there, and where social slights and kind of passive-aggressive snubs have been the ways in which people have dealt with each other. Like, that was so vicious. And there was just nothing else quite like it. And so that was when I started to feel like, oh, we've now entered a zone where people are actually really going to be militarized against this figure entering their world. And I felt like it kind of went back to where it mostly was beforehand. But that, to me, was an example of where, like, you could do something with how totally defended old money is against, not even new money, but against, like, an interloper without disrupting more. But I also thought the bachelor party sequences were, for me, and collectively, kind of the low point of the movie. It was where I felt like we were losing the most control over just, like, the narrative of this and, like, the friends getting married who'd seemed so great in that really wonderful sequence where they get introduced and go out to eat. Like, she at least suddenly seems way worse because the movie needs somebody to be bad right now. Like, and I just wanted to get out of there, although then we did. So, yeah.
I mean, that thing with the fish was maybe the edgiest thing they did. And so, yeah, more of that would have been fun. Like, if they raised the stakes in the next whatever confrontation to be something even a little bit more vicious while keeping the frothy tone, that would have been more fun.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. I was surprised at the bride, Armanita, that she was sort of shown, she only has two scenes really. One where she is like the best person, and two, she's the worst person.
Yeah.
You know, since we're full into spoilers, I did think the wedding was hilarious, though, the walking on water. Because the whole thing I could think is, like, oh my god, they're standing there in wet shoes for the rest of the ceremony, all the bridesmaids and the bride.
Well, the bride was shoeless, right? Like, which was, I thought, you know, that was great.
But can you imagine walking around in dripping wet clothes?
She changed her dress for the dancing, Nathaniel. You were not paying attention.
I know, but have you ever been to a wedding? They last forever. She was, trust me, she was in that wet gown for a while.
Nathaniel doesn't like to talk about this, but he is a crazy rich Singaporean, and he knows how those weddings go.
She probably changed 5 times, and they only showed us 2.
That's true.
But yeah, little dangling fireflies on fishing rods was not something I'd ever contemplated at the wedding.
That's true.
Approach. Got some tips.
So, I already told you guys I love Gemma Chan. I also thought Michelle Yeoh aced the role. And I was worried it was going to be more stereotypical.
Mm.
But I think it was her underplaying. I mean, people... Her critics say she's a wooden actress, but I like that she almost always opts for underplaying Michelle Yeoh. Mm-hmm. And I thought for this character it worked really well because she's so, you know, guarded about anything that's not her family.
Yeah.
And so I thought that worked really well for the character and also made the Mahjong scene, like, really pop for me. Because you're waiting for any micro expression, you know? And so any, like, slight differentiation that she does, I just thought she was really good in it. And I loved, like, as you said, Nick, I loved the way at the end they aren't, like, huggy. You know, it's just like sort of you know, you see them across a room acknowledge each other, but there's not even smiles. It's just sort of a nod, which I thought was great.
Yeah, I think, actually it was you, Murtada, who said that, I think, right? And, yeah, then I like that she's suddenly just gone, too.
Yeah.
And I also liked the underplaying. I think I might be, I don't know where you are, Murtada, I might be in the middle of, like, I also like that she underplayed. I also think it would not make sense for that character to be too agitated by this particular threat to whom she feels totally superior, so it seems smart. Do I think she needs to get an Oscar nomination for this movie? Like, maybe not. Like good baseline to set for your character. Totally good job.
I'm 100%.
Assessment.
Yeah, 100% with you on that. Like, she was fine. She had that scene in the, like, I liked her scene with Rachel where they're on the stairs and they sort of play their hands. Basically, they were both very good in that scene. I thought that was also Constance Wu's best moment. To play something different than what she was playing the rest of the film. But yeah, Oscar nomination, that would, for this part, yeah, that would be too much.
People have been nominated for much, much less.
Oh, no
for
question.
For sure, yeah.
She was better in this than Penelope Milford would have been. Yeah. I totally liked her.
If you want to nominate her for a career, oh, sure. And this
that's
is the part
I'm
where
saying, she, that's the type of role that gets someone a career nomination.
Yeah, then I would be behind that. But just as, like, I mean, the 5 best supporting actresses of the year, I don't think so. Not yet, anyway. Who knows? Maybe everybody appearing in the rest of the year will be terrible.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, my
total
list
total acting drought.
My list is not very long for supporting actress right now, so, but there's still a lot of movies left.
I really liked, I think the actress's name is Tan Kang Hwa, who played Rachel's mother, who doesn't have a lot of scenes, but I really liked what she did in them, and, like, the scene where they have to have a conversation about the past, I thought was really good from both of them.
Yeah, she was.
Yeah.
Yeah, I liked basically all the actors in this.
Yeah, and that actress, I think, is one of a few who are from Singapore. So,
oh yeah,
it's her and the guy who plays Astrid's husband, who I thought was the hottest guy.
Oh my god, I was so disappointed that he became a villain because I was just like, yes, give me a sequel with these two.
Sending him the text.
What?
Were you the person sending him the text?
In my fantasies.
Little cameo.
Yeah, that subplot, that's like, I think it's like, for somebody, you know, who is a fan of the book, not me, but for fans of the book, that is the subplot that was shortchanged by the movie, because Astrid and her husband are a big part in the book. And their story, like, you know, goes around and they go to Shanghai and Hong Kong and whatever. There's, like, a whole big story. And there's somebody else who appears for 2 seconds in the movie. So maybe if there is a sequel, I think those three will be a big part of it.
Yeah. Mm. I love that he's still got 6th billing, even though he's only in a little fragment during the credits. Like, way to go, agent of Harry Shum. But
yeah, and I...
Yeah, if you have to replace that guy, Harry Shum is the way to go.
For sure.
If you have to replace that hot, hot husband, it better be someone as easy on the eyes as Harry Shum.
And, like, that subplot to me was a good example of something that, like, part of me would have, I was about to say, like, would have liked a little bit more of that. On the other hand, I think it was actually really interesting that Astrid had so much less narrative time, but had such a totally different, sadder tone around her. And it was like she got to be the Emma Thompson in Love Actually or something, like just like the person who's constantly sounding this note that everything's not great. Mm-hmm. Ideally she might have had something a little less blunt to play than what we get from that subplot, although she herself doesn't act it bluntly. But then it also, this is going to sound like a crazy comparison, but it did also sort of remind me a bit of Sorry to Bother You in its avidity for pursuing so many characters and subplots, as though the movie does not ever expect to have a second chance to explore its ideas. And so even though it felt maybe like a flaw in some ways that the movie feels a little overstuffed, I also found myself feeling sympathetic to that. And kind of liking it, it felt like potentially not a weakness that you're watching a movie have to scramble to show you more people's lives who you're not going to meet.
Who is in trouble? Who has the sirens coming for them?
Oh, it's me, always.
They sounded very New York. I thought it was Nathaniel, but I guess sirens are everywhere.
Especially when you live down the street from the fire station.
Yeah.
So what else have you guys seen recently?
I saw Cameron Post, and I was just reading Murtada's interview with Desiree Akhavan before we all logged on. I don't actually know, I think you already had a podcast, though, about it, right?
Yeah, we talked about it a little bit.
I
mostly feel like it's a little flat. I mean, it's good, but it just, I want it to be, like, exciting to watch in some way.
Yeah. Yep, that's how I felt. Where that was also the most interesting thing about it, was to be that low-key about that subject, but my enthusiasm for that waned. As we continued to be low-key.
We don't have to discuss it, because I will be... we don't have to discuss it, but I watched Nick's favorite movie this week, Travels with My Aunt.
So mean. I didn't do anything to deserve what's happening right now.
Have you ever seen this, Matata?
I have not. Why is it Nick's favorite movie? I want to know.
It's a comedy from 1972.
Comedy is an interesting word. Keep going.
Is this the Maggie Smith one?
Yes. So Maggie Smith made the Best Actress lineup for what has to be her worst performance.
So,
oh my God.
Yeah.
Was this the Maggie Smith sort of nomination for being Brenda Bleson in Little Boys? How many years after her win was that?
3.
So it is that.
And it was totally... I kind of love those Oscar years where there's 4 nominees that you think...
are sensational.
Wow. Like,
yeah.
These are all fantastic in really different ways from each other, and also any of them could win, and then number 5 is like... What was it like to be you? Like, what is going on over here? And that is a great example of that.
Yeah.
That's the nice thing I can say about it. It's not even that nice, but that's as good as it's going to get.
Yeah.
I'm positive she has no idea she was nominated for that movie.
I also saw Your Name, that... animated movie from a couple years back that everybody wanted to get nominated for animated feature that did not. And have any of you seen it?
Yeah.
I thought it was really interesting, but speaking of movies that don't explore what you think they're going to explore or what seems like right there to explore, is that it's about, you know, for those who haven't seen it, it's about this teenage boy and this teenage girl who keeps switching places, like not like a Freaky Friday thing, like they just are inside each other's bodies whenever, you know, just at random times. And it didn't really explore anything about gender politics, which shocked me, actually.
I don't remember it well enough to say. I remember really liking it, but have you seen it, Murtada?
I have not seen that one, no.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was much different than I was expecting, but I just thought it was so weird to have this plot that was, like, begging for some sort of commentary on men and women and didn't have any, other than that men liked boobs, because there was a repeated funny joke about that.
Well, enough said, right?
Well, I saw the movie that has everything. You know, I saw Visconti's The Damned, which is, like, literally, I think now is my favorite movie I've ever seen ever.
Uh-huh.
Not exaggerating, but yes, because it's, like, it's Hamlet, but it's really campy, but it's also Macbeth, but it's, like, crazy and has all these Nazis and then sex and sort of, like, uncomfortable sex scenes, but also sexy sex scenes and somebody doing a drag Marlena Dietrich, like, I don't think anything in this year's movies is going to have anything like that.
Would you call it Crazy Rich Nazis?
Yes, that would be the perfect title for it.
Have you seen?
I should release it.
Have you seen that one, Nick?
Mm-mm. Yeah. I haven't really seen a lot of Visconti. I mean, I feel like it's always about, like, super rich people just barely hanging on who realize it's all about to not go well for them, but I haven't seen a lot of it.
Isn't it weird how all of these themes are so resonant right now? It seems like every movie I've seen from the past lately is suddenly very resonant.
So I'll tell you guys one line from The Damned that's going to just make you want to go and see it. So he tells his mom, "You've subjugated me with your lipsticks and your wigs, mother. What other movie?"
Said Eliza Blue. I spent last night watching I Feel Pretty and Blockers on either side of Crazy Rich Asians, so I sort of had, like, studio comedy day. So I saw I Feel Pretty partly because I think you had said nice things about it, Nathaniel.
Yeah, I liked it. It seemed to me, I know it's improper to critique other people's criticisms, but it seemed to me like a movie that people had knives out for without seeing it. Like, mm-hmm. The reaction was so immediate and so dismissive, and I actually thought the movie was fun and interesting.
Did you see it, Murtada?
I haven't seen it, but in my corner of Twitter, everybody was raving about Michelle Williams, so did you guys like her?
I was so surprised she had that kind of performance in her. She's, like, really fun and doing a weird thing the entire, which, like, eventually, like, becomes a plot point, which I wasn't really expecting. It doesn't ruin it, but it was just as fun when there was no reason for her to be doing it, and she was just like, maybe I'll. like, it's worth seeing for her, but there are a lot of people that are fun in it, and I felt like it had the same strength. I mean, it was interesting to see back-to-back with Crazy Rich Asians because they both are kind of really trying to say something and are also a little mixed about exactly what they're going to say or how they're going to say it.
Mm-hmm.
But in the way that in Trainwreck, I felt like it's all worth it just to get the relationship with Bill Hader because these are not the usual leads, like those characters even more than those actors are not the usual leads of this kind of movie, and she has another love story with a really appealingly average dude. And her own averageness is being emphasized. And, like, the middle third of it, which is both when that's mostly happening and when Michelle Williams is in full glory, is, like, the reason to see the movie, I would say.
Oh.
Yeah. And I loved that guy. I thought they had such natural chemistry, but not movie chemistry. It felt like real-life chemistry because it was awkward and also sort of like, what do I think of this person the whole time that you're attracted to them?
Yeah.
Which I loved because I don't really see that in movies.
Yeah.
Whereas in real life, like, attraction often comes with this mix of, what am I doing? I think. Maybe I'm saying too much about myself.
No, say more.
So I think that movie got very unjust hate. I liked it. So check that out.
Did you guys see Madeline's Madeline?
Opens here in 2 weeks.
I was going to see that yesterday, but plans fell through.
Are you a fan?
I'm not, but it's a movie that I think is worth discussing. It's very odd. And you can see why some people love it, but I didn't, so I would love to talk about it. But, you know, maybe when you guys see it.
Maybe we'll invite Barry Jenkins on to argue with you, Murtada.
Yes, that would be fun.
Yeah. Of all the threats I've ever heard, that's like the most appealing one. I saw two of her previous movies, and they were kind of similar to each other, and yet one of them I really liked, and the other one I really didn't. So I haven't had any idea what to expect.
What did she make before?
One was called Butter on the Latch, and one was called Thou Wast Something and Lovely. I'm pretty sure that's the one I didn't like. But I confuse them in my mind now. And it was one of those things where, like, I felt like none of her movies got a big push, and then suddenly, like, Anthology or MoMA or somebody was like, you needed to have seen all of these. And so they showed, like, her first three movies all together. And The New Yorker got, I think, those were their second and third favorite movies of the year that year, which was why I tried.
Wow.
Yeah, so she's interesting, but like you're saying, totally weird, and I don't know, I'm curious.
Yeah, she's definitely like, now I'm curious, hearing you say that, and then having watched it, like, I'm curious to watch what else she has done. Yeah.
What's her name?
Josephine Decker.
Okay.
I saw that Barry Jenkins said this movie has one of the best performances I've ever seen. So even whether you agreed or didn't agree, who is he talking about, do you think?
He's talking about the young woman who plays Madeline. I think her name is Helena Howard, so she is a teenager, very young actress. She is spectacular, yes.
Okay. Well, eyes out for that one.
All right. Those are the only things I've seen recently. So I don't have any other movies to talk about. Oh, that I want to talk about. I saw The Darkest Minds, which was terrible. I saw it strictly to see Harris Dickinson again from Beach Rats. This time playing a traditional romantic fantasy male lead.
So he's an example of somebody who, when you're attracted to him, you're not asking yourself why you're attracted to him.
Well, in this movie, I was asking myself why.
Oh, whoa, okay.
Well, Nathaniel, we should find what else Pierre Peng, who plays Michael Tao in Crazy Rich Asians, has been in, so we can have like a week of hot guy movies. You can bring a couple from Harris Dickinson, too.
He's only made a couple, so...
Or maybe just the one.
Yeah, exactly.
The guy who produced that was my student, like, 12 years ago. And so I'm, you know, it's always, like, you want to like everything that somebody that you worked with did. And it worked out with Arrival, but it didn't work out. I gather this one people are more mixed about, so I have not gone.
Oh, The Darkest Minds?
Yes.
I will say... sorry, what were you saying?
The guy who co-wrote Crazy Rich Asians was my neighbor on an army base when I was in kindergarten, and he was my brother's best friend. And, like, nothing about their, like, football-worshipping family ever suggested to me that he was headed to Hollywood. But he wrote The Proposal also, the Sandra Bullock comedy. And so, it's like all kinds of folks from the past are showing up in the movie theater these days.
You're like a good luck charm or something.
Well, and just hilarious, like, given what this movie's about, to be like, the screenwriter is from an army base in upstate New York. They say write what you know, but...
So what's the name of the guy who produced Arrival and The Darkest Mind, who was your student?
Dan Cohen. Such a sweet guy.
I will say about The Darkest Minds that Gwendolyn Christie from Game of Thrones understood what movie she was in, and nobody else did.
Okay.
She was just really out there, really camp, and you know, committed to what she decided to do with her performance.
I can't tell if you're complimenting her or not.
I am. Okay. I am, because in a movie like that, you better be having fun as an actor. You know? Like, if you're not, you're doing something wrong.
Oh, she is an actor, because you would not tell by being in Games of Thrones that she was one.
Ooh, I can tell you're not complimenting her.
Definitely not. Yep.
No, I'm not saying, I haven't seen enough of her work to know if she has any range, but I liked that she understood what movie she was in. Because everyone else plays it earnest, and I was like, Ernest is not what this movie needs to survive. there's enough Ernest in everything about it without the actors going there, too.
Yes.
Ooh. Speaking of Ernest, sorry, I just remembered the other thing that I saw, which is not technically a movie, but it's the best thing I've seen all year. It's America to Me, the 10-hour... documentary series by Steve James, the Hoop Dreams Interrupters guy that starts on Stars a week from when we're recording this. So on Sunday the 26th. And it's 10 one-hour episodes that will run until the end of October about a pretty affluent public high school outside of Chicago. And by the standards of, like, of sort of well-to-do community public high schools, it's relatively diverse, although certainly could be more so. But the filmmakers wanted to figure out why, even in a liberal, progressive area that really does invest in public schools, there still is such a stubborn racial achievement gap. And it's actually been getting worse while they've been trying to work on it. And so you spend the 10 hours with, like, 12 kids and about 6 teachers, and it manages to follow all of these plot lines super clearly. And imagine getting to watch something like Hoop Dreams of the Interrupters for 10 hours. It's really fantastic. I mean, I have a lot of reasons to be invested in it, but I don't think it was just, like, subjective bias that I found it so engrossing. So I would absolutely recommend people watch that.
Where can we watch it?
It'll just be on Stars Sunday nights, starting on the 26th.
And if you don't have Stars, I understand you can get it as part of your Amazon Prime for a couple extra dollars.
That's right.
A month.
And I think they've talked about having, like, a couple of sort of encore runs in the theater, maybe just in New York and L.A., but that might or might not happen. I think.
And also, 10 hours is a long time to sit in a movie theater.
Yeah, but I mean, I watched The Mile.
We've never done that.
I saw The Spider House Rules, and that was 14 hours.
Oh, did you guys hear about this movie that was at Locarno that's going to be at TIFF in New York, and I think it's 14 hours? I think it's called La Flor.
Yeah.
It's called what?
La Flor.
Okay, I'm writing it down so that I never, ever approach it.
I think they are presenting it in 3 sits. So it's not like the 14 hours altogether. I think it's 5, 5, 4.
Not for me.
I'm going to bonk you on the head and drag you there, and you're going to wake up and be like, where am I? And be like, ha, you're at La Flor. And we're just going to do it.
Oh, think of all the movies you could fit into your screening schedule.
90% of The Green Mile. You would almost get through the whole thing.
Oh, all right. So, I'm sweating, so I need to turn on my air conditioner. It's a sacrifice I've made for this podcast so that you don't, so you can actually hear me.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I turned off my air conditioner too, so it's not just me, but also Philip, who's suffering right now.
So much suffering in the world.
Well, I have
all my closed, and you could still hear the sirens that loud. So, a little bit about what it means to be me. Plus, I'm a tenured professor, so I'm like a fishwife. Like, I barely scrape by.
It was fun to talk. I think this is the last eventful movie weekend for a while.
What do you mean? Glenn Close is going to be opening everywhere.
No, but she came out this weekend, the same weekend as Crazy Rich Asians.
But only in New York and L.A.
Right. But we don't know how soon she's going to show up in other places. The traveling Glenn Close exhibition.
She's going to show up when she wants to, is one answer.
I'm going to see her on stage in October.
In what?
In whatever play she's doing in October.
It's a play where she plays the mother of Joan of Arc, and it's written by Jane Anderson, who wrote the screenplay for The Wife.
Oh, wow.
Who also wrote Olive Kittredge.
And The Positively True Adventures of the Alleged Texas Cheerleader Murdering Mom.
Wow.
Which is sublime.
Yeah, so Glenn is spending all year with her work.
That's right. So you know one name she's going to list during her Oscar speech.
That's for sure.
Not to jinx it.
I mean, like, to your point, like you said, if she gets nominated, I don't think anybody of, like, the top 20 will have a narrative as strong as her. So she just needs to get nominated. And I think I agree with you, Nathaniel, when you said if she gets nominated, she'll win.
I kind of love that this has both been a total come from behind, like, I mean, you saw it at Toronto last year, right,
yeah.
Nathaniel?
But I'm the only person who saw it at Toronto last year.
Yeah. Like, there were no public sort of incentives or big bright arrows pointing toward it. And so it's like this movie that made a total case for itself, which is kind of great. While at the same time, it's like, how all in could you go for your Oscar narrative? Like, I'm going to be an unrewarded person playing a chronically unrewarded person. My fucking daughter's playing my daughter. Like, we are doing this. Like, make this the night of my life, you assholes. Like, so... way to be tangential and also right on the nose.
Yeah. Do you guys want to know what my favorite thing that she said in all of her press tour for The Wife? So I don't know if you watched the Time Stock. Time Stock did a sit down with her and with Meg Wolitzer. Uh-huh. And so the moderator of that was like listing her iconic roles. So she was like, Glenn Close, you know, you played Alex Forrest in Fatal Attraction. You were Cruella de Vil. You were in Dangerous Liaisons. And then Glenn interrupts her, and she's like, and Albert Nobbs, twice.
Keep beating the drum.
Maybe she'll get that Oscar for Albert Nobbs yet.
I know, right? So
Maybe Michelle Yeoh could have explained to her that your personal passions are not everything in the world.
Yeah, you wouldn't think that was something she would want to.
Man, I think she's definitely thanking Albert Nobbs in his speech.
Oh, goodness.
Hopefully she goes to the ceremony as Albert Nobbs.
All right, guys. Thanks for tuning in, everyone. This is Nathaniel, and I'm thank you, Murtada.
Thank you, and talk to you soon.
And Nick.
Yep. Talk to you guys soon.